Chapter 20. We're going to run through a few chapters. Thing about David's life, and when we look at this, and we touched a little bit about him being in the cave this morning, but when we get to this section of David's life, the big question, why? I mean, we know why now as we look back at his life. But look at it. Try to put yourself in his shoes. I mean, all these things are happening to him, and he hasn't the foggiest idea of why. He has no comprehension as what's going on. There's no answers. The Lord is not saying, now, David, I just want you to know that for the next 10 years, it's going to be rough. There's going to be a lot of trials, but this is all going to work out for your good and purpose. And you're going to write lots of psalms in this time, David. I mean, it's going to be real cool for lots of people for the rest of eternity. But for now, you know, this is what's happening. Just be cool. He doesn't tell David that. I mean, it's the big question mark. Why? And to me, this really helps me because for my own life, I don't understand why the Lord allowed so many things. I don't understand why he doesn't just, you know, set everything up perfectly for his children and say, all right, let's bang it out. We'll knock it together here. Everything's going to be perfect. Why can't we just get a new facility and get going with the school and all these things happening right away? Why? You know, and yet all these things, actually, God is working together in our life for a perfect purpose. That when we look back down the road, we'll look back and we'll go, all right, Lord, now I see. It was great. And the real challenge for all of us is to thank him ahead of time before we see the answer. That's the real challenge. And so when we come to David's situation, we have that question, and it's a good question. We need to ask that question. I want to look at this. So let's jump in chapter 20. David fled from Naoth and Ramah. Now, we left him off where Saul was coming by his house to kill him. He threw a spear at him again, and then he sent messengers to David's house to try to kill him, lie in wait. And Michal, his wife, saved him. It's the last time he'll be together with her as husband and wife. Actually, he does bring her away from another husband that Saul gives her out to, and it's just a real bad situation. But can you imagine, you know, your own wife being taken and given to somebody else, and then you come back into the scene? Then he came by David at Samuel's house when David went to Samuel, figuring, hey, the only friend I've got, Samuel. He's the one that anointed me. Remember, Samuel? Help me out. This guy's trying to kill me. And Samuel, really, though he's the prophet, does not have any power over Saul. It's gone to his head. And so there's no comfort there, and he runs from there. And Saul then, of course, gets caught up in prophesying because the Lord stops him. And every step, you know, just when it looks like David's going to die, God stops him. But he fled from Naoth and Ramah and went and said to Jonathan, what have I done? Now he's appealing to his friend. He's made a covenant with Jonathan, the son of Saul. He says, what have I done? What's my iniquity? What's my sin before your father that he seeks my life? So Jonathan said to him, by no means, you will not die. Indeed, my father will do nothing either great or small without first telling me. Why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so. And David took an oath again and said, your father certainly knows that I have found favor in your eyes. And he said, do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death. You can feel where David is at. Have you ever been so close to death in your own understanding? Like, it's right around the corner. This is not working out for me. And from David's perspective, that's what it was. He'd had a couple of close calls with a javelin inches away from him. Saul sought to, you know, stick him to the wall. And needless to say, everything that's happening to David, it's all a part of God's strategic training, showing David that God is sufficient. And yet, in each situation, David's perspective is, I almost died. I know that I look back at my own life, and probably you've had close calls in your own experience with death. And you know, you can look back and you go, man, just an inch this way and we would have been dead. I remember a couple of times in an airplane, you know, things happened. We were flying back from a missionary trip, coming down real low, and everything was looking good. And in the last second, the airplane pulled up real fast. Later we found out that it was in the heat that the tarp, or the whatever you call it, where the airplane lands, had buckled. All the asphalt was just rippled. because of the heat. And he had to pull up real quick. I remember another time in a car, which this was another missionary trip. I'll never forget this one. In Bogota, Colombia, going from Bogota down to Villa Vicencio. And driving that road on a Friday evening, these people live dangerously over there, let me tell you. I mean, there are candles all along the road where people had went off the edge. No guardrail, a mountainous road, and people delight in passing on a curve, blindsided around the mountain, and you're coming around, and all of a sudden they're right there, and you have to slam on the brakes, and they get over. And but the tricky thing is staying alive, because all these candles along the road, and you may be burning their necks, you know, as a little candle in memorial to whoever went over. And I'll never forget coming around a corner, and there was a bus, and he was in our lane, and we swerved and missed him by inches off the side of the road. And I'm like, Lord, is this what missionary life is like? But I've had close calls, and yet when I think about it, and I think that David, he was very, very close to death, and he could almost taste it. And he said to Jonathan, there's but a step between me and death. And yet that was a very important time in his life, because in this time from chapter 20 through the rest of this book, we're going to find many issues in life of David which bring him to that place of just pouring his soul out before the Lord. In fact, we don't have time to go through many of the psalms he wrote in this period. There's so many of them. I'll try to point out some of them as we're going through the verses so you can connect the psalm to that situation. So David said this, there's but a step between me and death. Question is, if that were true, and if it were true in your own life, would you be ready? Are you ready for death? That's something we don't like to think about, actually. It's something we like to put in the back of our mind, and rightly so. It's not that we should have this morbid thinking about death all the time. But at the same time, are you ready? In those times I've had those close calls, I remember the feeling of the instant that I thought something was going to happen. And it was like, it was really a sense of peace. Like, wow, is this it? I'm going to wake up and I'm going to be in the presence of God. Because in reality, to a Christian, that's what it's like. It's not the woeful thing that people think. It's you're going from one dwelling place to another dwelling place. Now, death to a non-believer is quite different. You stand before your judge. And a terrifying experience that will be. In Revelation, you see the terror that people have when they stand before the wrath of the Lamb in His judgment. And it's a horrible thing. But to those of you who have been forgiven of your sins, you have an incredible promise. It's quite different. Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. Life really is right around the corner of death. So David responds this way, but Jonathan says to David, whatever you yourself desire, I'll do it for you. And David said to Jonathan, indeed, tomorrow is the new moon. But I should not fail to sit with the king to eat, but let me go that I may hide in the field until the third day at evening. And your father misses me. If he misses me at all, then say, David earnestly asked permission of me that he might run over to Bethlehem, his city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family. And if he says thus, it is well, your servant will be safe. But if he is angry, then be sure that evil is determined by him. Therefore you shall deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. Nevertheless, if there is iniquity in me, kill me yourself, for why should you bring me to your father? Now Jonathan gets a little ticked off at this. And I think that this is really reasonable on Jonathan's part to be a little upset. He feels that David is doubting his friendship. But it's also reasonable that David would feel this way. He has come so close to dying. He doesn't know which end is up. He is being stretched to the limit. And he's even coming to that place of doubting his own best friend, Jonathan. And Jonathan's a little ticked and said, far be it from you. For if I knew certainly that evil was determined by my father to come upon you, then would I not tell you? And David said to Jonathan, well, who will tell me? What if your father answers you roughly? We looked at this as a picture a couple of weeks ago in regard to the aspect of persecution, the dilemma of persecution. Now, Jonathan said to David, come, let us go out to the field. So both of them went out to the field. And Jonathan said to David, the Lord God of Israel is witness. When I have sounded out my father sometime tomorrow or the third day, indeed there is good toward David, and I do not send to you and tell you, may the Lord do so and much more to Jonathan. But if it pleases my father to do you evil, then I will report it to you and send you away that you may go in safety, and may the Lord The Lord be with you as he has been with my father. Notice the past tense, as he has been. And you shall not only show me the kindness of the Lord while I still live, that I may not die, but you shall not cut off your kindness from my house forever. No, not when the Lord has cut off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. Now, Jonathan even sees that down the road it's going to be different. Jonathan is going to be at David's mercy. And he realizes that God is raising up David. He doesn't know what's going to transpire, how it's going to happen, but he knows it's going to happen. So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "Let the Lord require of it at the hand of David's enemies." And Jonathan again caused David to vow because he loved him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. And Jonathan said to David, "Tomorrow is a new moon, and you will be missed because your seat will be empty. And when you have stayed 3 days, go down quickly and come to the place where you hid on the day of the deed and remain by the stone easel." Now, the word easel means departure. So this will be where they depart eventually. He says, "Then I'll shoot 3 arrows to the side of it as though I shot at a target. And there I will send a lad saying, 'Go find the arrows.' If I expressly say to the lad, 'Look, the arrows are on this side of you, get then and come, for as the Lord lives, there is safety for you and no harm.' But if I say thus to the young man, 'Look, the arrows are behind you, go your way, for the Lord has sent you away. And as for the manner which you and I have spoken of, indeed the Lord be between you and me forever.'" So now everything is coming down to David's life, his one last friend that can mean anything in his life. It all comes down to standing there by this stone, waiting for arrows to fly. Everything's coming down to his life in this one moment. Will the arrows come this side of the stone or on that side of the stone? I can't help but relate this in our lives in a way that just thinking in terms of whatever way the arrow flies. I mean, so many things can happen. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. We don't know whether we'll lose our job or whether something will happen with a loved one. Life is very frail. And I think we need to look at it this way. So many things can happen. It can go this way or that way. And David, I mean, think about them. What a pathetic picture of him waiting down there for 3 days. You know, he went to Bethlehem, probably had that time with his family, and then comes back and waits by that stone all alone. They had to do it kind of secretly because if someone saw David and reported to Saul, he'd be in big trouble. So David hid in the field, and when the new moon had come, the king sat down to eat the feast, and the king sat on his seat, as at other times, on a seat by the wall, and Jonathan arose, and Abner sat by Saul's side, but David's place was empty. Nevertheless, Saul did not say anything that day, for he thought, "Something's happened to him. He's unclean. Surely he's unclean," which would have been, you couldn't keep the feast if you were unclean, so you'd be exempt from it. So Saul figures, well, he probably was unclean. Something happened. Either he was in a battle with a Philistine and killed him, and since he came in contact to a dead body, he has to wait for a period of time. But it happened the next day, the second day of the month, that David's place was empty, and Saul said to Jonathan, his son, "Why has the son of Jesse not come to eat either yesterday or today?" And Jonathan answered Saul, "David earnestly asked permission of me to go to Bethlehem. And he said, 'Please let me go, for our family has a sacrifice in the city. And my brother has commanded me to be there. And now if I have found favor in your eyes, please let me get away and see my brothers.' Therefore he has not come to the king's table." And Saul's anger was aroused against Jonathan, and he said to him, "You son of a perverse and rebellious woman." Wow. "Do I not know you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and the shame of your mother's nakedness?" Now here is where he hits his son below the belt. He hits him hard now in bringing shame to his own mother. That would have been, in an Eastern culture, the epitome of an insult. I mean, insult me, hit me, do whatever you want, but don't talk about my mother. Don't talk about my family. And yet here Saul, his own father, is bringing this out and shaming him. And he says, "For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, you shall not be established, nor your kingdom. Now therefore send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die." And Jonathan answered Saul, his father, and said to him, "Why should he be killed? What has he done?" And Saul cast a spear at him to kill him, by which Jonathan knew it was determined by his father to kill David. Saul always seems to be close by to a spear. I'm telling you, I wouldn't like to have dinner with this guy. Gets upset at you and that spear starts flying at you. Even his own son, I mean, whether he intended really to hit him or just to scare him or with his anger, you know, his wrath. But Jonathan nonetheless arose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had treated him shamefully. So when it was in the morning, Jonathan went out into the field at the time appointed with David, and a little lad was with him. And he said to the lad, "Now run and find the arrows which I shoot." And as the lad ran, he shot an arrow beyond him. And when the lad had come to the place where the arrow was with Jonathan, which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan cried out after the lad and said, "Is not the arrow beyond you?" Now I think this is a major, major test in David's life. Here he is now going to be separated from his only friend, and yet not truly, for the Lord is watching out for him. David's stressed to the point of sitting there by that stone waiting. Saul, in fierce anger and hatred and enmity toward him for no cause, in which David becomes a perfect type of Christ, who they hated him without a cause. For envy they delivered him up. And here's the situation. I would imagine as Jonathan is shooting that arrow, his heart must have been broken. David's heart, true, watching that arrow, hearing the word, "The arrow's beyond you," must have sunk in his heart. Just the feeling, "What am I going to do now?" Well, Jonathan then cried out after the lad, "Make haste, hurry, and do not delay." So Jonathan's lad gathered up the arrows and came back to his master. But the lad did not know anything. Only Jonathan and David knew of the matter. Then Jonathan gave his weapons to his lad, said to him, "Go carry them to the city." And as soon as the lad had gone, David arose from the place toward the south. So obviously there was no one around. They checked, scoped out the land, but they got together. They fell on his face to the ground and bowed down three times. And they kissed one another, and they wept together, but David more so. And Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, since we have both sworn in the name of the Lord, saying, 'May the Lord be between you and me, between your descendants and my descendants forever.'" So he departed, and Jonathan went into the city. This is the last. There's only one other time they'll meet before Jonathan is killed in a battle with his father Saul, the end of this book. And David is raised up eventually, but not quite immediately. But this covenant that he makes with Jonathan here lasts through the years. In fact, there's a very strange situation that happens later when David was put in power. A famine came into the land, and as many times as a famine would happen, as the people were in tune with the Lord, they'd ask the Lord, "Why are we suffering? What's going on? Is there something you're trying to get our attention?" And so this famine came, and David sought the Lord, and the Lord told him it was because of the Gibeonites that Saul had killed and put many of them to death. Now, the Gibeonites were a people that Joshua made a covenant with, and because of that covenant, he could do them no harm and actually had to protect them in battle. But Saul did not honor that covenant, treated them shamefully, horribly, killed many of them. And because of that, God's wrath came upon Israel because they violated the covenant they made with someone. And, you know, those days you make a covenant, even if it's just a verbal covenant, you kept your word. So Saul violated it, and as a result, famine came into the land in the time of David. Very strange. In other words, justice must be met. Something had to be done. So David said, "Well, what should I do?" So he called the Gibeonites and said, "What can be done for you on behalf of what Saul has done for you?" And they said, "We don't want anything else except for seven of Saul's descendants to be put to death. You know, just in retribution of what he has done to us." Now, there was a young man that was actually a son of Jonathan. And when David first came into power, he inquired as to whether or not there were any sons of Jonathan that he could show kindness to. And there was one son who was actually lame in his feet. When he was a young boy, the nurse fell on top of him, and his feet became crippled, or maybe they broke his legs and they didn't form properly, so he couldn't walk. His name was Mephibosheth. And David sought to bless him and honor him, and he called Mephibosheth to his presence. And of course, Mephibosheth, being a descendant of Saul, thought that David was going to kill him. So he came and, you know, bowed down before David and was waiting to die. And David said, "You know, I want you to sit at my table. I want you to be honored." And he gave him all these possessions and land and restored the land of Saul to him. And Mephibosheth was like, "What am I, a dead dog that you should do this? I mean, why are you honoring me this way?" And he says, "Because of the covenant I made with your father, Jonathan." Now, when the Gibeonites were being harsh on Saul's descendants, and David found it necessary to put to death seven of them, he spared Mephibosheth and had others that were put to death in his place. So this covenant David keeps with Jonathan. Now David came to Nob to Ahimelech the priest. And Ahimelech was afraid when he met David and said, "Why are you alone and no one is with you?" Now when you read this chapter, you got to feel sorry for this poor priest. He's trying to help David and David lies to him. Then he tries to tell the truth with Saul and Saul doesn't believe him and ends up, you know, dealing with him harshly. So poor guy, you know, I feel for this guy. But David said to Ahimelech the priest, now David, you got to understand, he's on the lam. He's running for his life. He doesn't know who to trust, who he can trust. So he goes to the house of the Lord, and I think that's telling. I think it's a very important picture for someone when you're in a place of distress. You seek comfort in the house of the Lord, and certainly that's what David is doing. But he's not comfortable enough with Ahimelech to tell him what's going on. So he says, well, the king has ordered me on some business and said to me, don't let anyone know anything about the business in which I send you or which I command you. And I've directed my young men to such and such a place. Now, therefore, what have you on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread in my hand or whatever can be found. So Ahimelech's surprised. Why is this general alone? That seemed very strange. Asked him a question, and David gets afraid and begins to make up this story. The priest answered David and said, well, there's no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread. The young men have at least kept themselves from women. Now, the holy bread was probably the bread that each week, each Sabbath day, was put fresh in the little tabernacle area. They didn't have a tabernacle proper at the time, but they probably had the implements there, the table of showbread. And it was a table of bread that was put before the Lord. Later in the temple, you had the table of showbread, the candlestick, the 7-branch candlestick, and then the altar of incense, the 3 pieces of furniture in the holy place, and the Ark of the Covenant beyond the veil. And I believe the bread was there to represent that God is our sustenance. He provides for us, and He gives us our daily bread. And this picture here, I believe it's also Jesus says, I am the bread of life, and He is really a picture of that show bread. But it was required that each Sabbath day they take the old bread out, and then the priests can eat it, and they put fresh bread in. Well, that's the only bread he's got on hand, and it's really meant for the priests. But Ahimelech realizes, and I think for the common sense of it, realizes, hey, the guy's hungry, needs food, that's all we've got. So, you know, he can have it, at least if they've kept themselves from women and kept pure and not defiled themselves. And David answered the priest and said to him, truly, women have been kept from us for about 3 days since I came out, and the vessels of the young men are holy, and the bread is in effect common, even though it was sanctified in the vessel this day. So the priest gave him holy bread, for there was no bread there but the show bread which had been taken from before the Lord in order to put hot bread in its place on the day it was taken. Now, it's amazing that Jesus would use this as an illustration. Remember when they were arguing about the Sabbath, and they were accusing Jesus of violating the Sabbath, because his disciples had grabbed some grain and rubbed it in their hands, and the priests at that time had made such incredible laws or traditions on top of the laws. Truly, it was not rightful on the Sabbath day that they work and thresh the grain, or to winnow it, or to harvest the field. That would have been work. And they were to rest on the seventh day. But the traditions had got to a point where if you plucked a little bit of grain just to eat, and you rubbed it in your hand, that was threshing it. And if you threw the shells out, that was winnowing it. And then if you ate it, you're harvesting it and you're eating it. And that was wrong and it was a violation. And so Jesus is down there. He kept the law of Moses, but the traditions of men, he did not honor. He did not regard them. And of course, the Pharisees came and said, why are you doing this? You're violating the Sabbath by eating the grain, your disciples. And he says, did you not know what David did when he came for bread and they gave him the only bread that was there, the showbread, which was not lawful for anyone but the priest to eat? And Jesus said, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And I love that picture because really it put in perspective God's compassion for people, which overweighed a ceremonial law. Even in the same way that if any one of the Pharisees had one of their donkeys or their oxen stumble in a hole on the Sabbath day, they wouldn't leave him there because it was work to pull him out. They'd pull him out having compassion on the animal. And so Jesus sets that right, and he uses this as an illustration. Now, verse 7 says, a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord. And his name was Doeg, an Edomite, the chief of the herdsmen who belonged to Saul. And David said to Ahimelech, is there not here on hand a sword or spear or sword? For I have neither brought my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's business required haste. And the priest said, the sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah, there it is wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you will take that, take it, for there is no other except the one that is here. And David said, there is none like it. Give it to me. And David arose and fled that day from before Saul. Obviously seeing Doeg there, the herdsman of Saul, got a little nervous, ended up fleeing, and went to Achish, the king of Gath. Now, David's heart was not right. He lied to the priest. Something wrong here. His fear is leading him to do things that are pushing the panic button. And as a result, what's happened here is he's running to Achish. Now, Achish is actually the leader, one of the principal leaders at Gath, which was the principal city of the Philistines. Now, the strange thing is, David is the one that killed Goliath of Gath. Why would he go to Gath, of all places, where he might even run into one of Goliath's brothers who would, you know, try to take vengeance out on him? But certainly Achish would have known who he is. And here's where it becomes a very strange situation. Achish, he comes to Achish. Obviously he knew Achish. But the servants of Achish said to him, is this not David, the king of the land? Did they not sing of him to one another in their dances, saying, Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands? I think Saul would have been pretty frustrated to hear that the song even got into the hand of his enemies. But David then took these words to heart and was very much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. Now, I have a theory about this, and I may be wrong, but I believe that David somehow or another was friends with Achish. He knew Achish. And it could quite possibly have been as a result of killing Goliath. Maybe Achish's political opponent was Goliath, and when David killed Goliath, Achish thought, all right, I'm next in line. I don't know, that's just a speculation. But something has to answer this problem here, because later on, David does go to Achish and has a great relationship with him. And if that's the case, if he knew Achish, why is he afraid here? The only thing I can think of is that David realizes that the servants of Achish recognize him and are afraid as a result of him, and that would have been political suicide for Achish to have given him any help. And so Achish now is put on the spot, and David is actually given Achish a way out, because he's afraid now that Achish might have to do something drastic just to save his political career. And so David then, very, very afraid of this because of the words that are spoken, now he's really confused. He was even in the camp of the enemy. He, you know, picture this. Now set this for your own life. You're in a real tight spot. So you come to the house of the Lord, you come to church, and things aren't what you expect. Maybe something confronts you, you know, and some person confronts you and says, hey, where you been? What's going on with your life? And you feel put on the spot, and you know you've come back because you're in a tough spot, but you don't want to have to open up to anybody. You don't know who to trust. And so you kind of like give a little fib, and the next thing you know, you're just feeling really guilty, and it's just not working. So you run back to the world. David runs to the Philistines. Now he's even run out of the covenant land of Israel. He's lapsed in his faith. Certainly, you've probably lapsed in your faith before. I mean, I think that what encourages me is that these great men of God, you see them struggle. Kind of encourages you, hey, we're going to struggle, but at the same time, let's keep coming back to the Lord. Remember Elijah facing the prophets of Baal? Takes care of them, but then he ends up running from one woman, Jezebel. Great faith facing those 400 prophets. Fire comes out of heaven. And yet the next moment you see him running from one woman, afraid, terrified for his life. Runs nearly 100 miles. Can you imagine running 100 miles to get away from Jezebel and hiding in the cave and then saying, God, just kill me. You know, take my life. I'm the only one that's left. And the Lord has to encourage him. Remember Abraham, he had his lapse of faith. Because of the famine in the land, he found himself down in Egypt, and Pharaoh saw his wife already had to be in her 60s, and yet she was so beautiful that he was afraid that he would be killed on her behalf. And so he lied to the Pharaoh and says, oh, she's my sister. And Pharaoh took her in and was going to prepare her to be his wife. And Abraham was just thinking of his own life, not thinking of her. But then God spoke to Pharaoh and says, you're a dead man if you touch that woman. And ended up getting him out of it. And then later on, he did the same thing to Ahimelech, lied about his wife to Ahimelech because he was afraid. She must have been one gorgeous lady to be so afraid that he would be killed on her behalf. And yet, Abraham, the man of faith, had a lapse in faith. And here's David running into the land of the Philistines and now even afraid there. And so what does he resort to? I think if you talked about a low time in David's life, this was it. This, I think, is the bottom of the bottom. Verse 13, it says, he changed his behavior before them and feigned madness in their hands, scratched on the doors of the gate and let his saliva fall down on his beard. Folks, here's the young man who went out and killed Goliath. Now he's so afraid, he's acting like a madman, you know, letting drool on his lips and come down his beard. And Achish said to his servants, look, you see the man is insane. Why have you brought him here to me? Now again, I think Achish is probably thanking David for giving him an out so he didn't have to kill David. Because the servants recognize his who he is, and Achish, I believe that because later on David gets together with Achish, and Achish loves him and gives him a city, that there must have been a relationship between these guys. So Achish then says, why have you brought him to me? See, he's insane. Have I need of a madman that you have brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? So shall this fellow come into my house? Tradition says that Achish, his wife and his child were both mad, that they both had a problem, a mental disorder, and that Achish said, do I need another person that's mad at my family? Get him out of here. And we don't know whether that's true or not. Tradition has that. So then David departs from there and escapes to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and his father's house heard it, they went down there to him. So now he's going to start with his encouragement. God's going to encourage him with a few. But notice in verse 2, the people that join him, everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented gathered to him. So he became captain over them, and there were there about 400 men with him. Now David, I love this picture here. Psalm 34 speaks about the time when he feigned madness. You can read that. Psalm 56 and 57 are also during this time of going to Ahimelech the priest and seeing Doeg. There's a psalm even about Doeg where he recognizes this guy and he realizes that this guy is going to cause him a lot of trouble. And sure enough, we're going to see in this chapter that that happens exactly as he predicted. But now he has got a small following. About 400 men have joined him. Men who have heard where he is through the grapevine, the underground, and have snuck out to him. And he becomes captain. David went there from Mizpah of Moab, and he said to the king of Moab, please let my father and mother come here with you till I know what God will do for me. So now he's got friends in Moab also. So he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. Now the Moabites were not friendly with Israelites, and yet there is a connection. Do you remember the connection that David quite possibly could have with the king of Moab? Well, if you know who the father of David is, Jesse, and who the father of Jesse is Boaz. Or, I'm sorry, Obed. The father of Obed was Boaz. And Boaz married Ruth, who was a Moabitess. It's believed by some that she was actually a princess and that there is a connection there. But even if she wasn't a princess, he had understanding, he had a relationship through his great-great-grandmother, Ruth. And I believe that's the connection that he has, and that's why he entrusts his own family. Now, he does this probably because Saul will stop at nothing to get David, and so he's protecting his own family. So they dwelt in the stronghold. I'm sorry, they brought him before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. Now, it's not quite certain from the text here whether he's referring to the stronghold there in Moab or the stronghold there in Adullam, because the prophet Gad said to David, do not stay in the stronghold, depart and go into the land of Judah. So David departed and went into the forest of Herath. So whether the stronghold is referring to the cave of Adullam or there in Moab, I believe it very well could be either or, and it's not certain. But when Saul heard David and the men who were with him had been discovered, now Saul was staying in Gibeah under a tamarisk tree in Ramah with his spear in his hand and all his servants standing about him. Now you're going to see something about the character of Saul here that should really blow your mind. You know, this guy has totally backslidden. He is so afraid of his own position. He doesn't know who to trust even in his own army. Saul said to his servants who stood about him, "Hear now, you Benjamites. Will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds? All of you have conspired against me, and there is no one who reveals to me that my son has made a covenant with the son of Jesse, and there is not one of you who's sorry for me or reveals to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as it is to this day." You know, what a pathetic picture. I mean, this guy has a real problem. You know, none of you feel sorry for me. You know, when you have to hold on to your authority in such a way, it's better to give it up. You've already lost it. If, you know, a leader is a leader when there is a following, when someone recognizes that the person is worthy of leadership. You can't force people to follow you. You can't force people. I hate the type of leadership that lords over people. Person gets in a position, even in the church I see this, and it really bugs me. Because Jesus said we should lead by example. Now, if Saul was leading by example, here's a pretty pathetic picture. You know, none of you feel sorry for me. None of you guys are helping me out. It's not fair. Nobody loves me anymore. You know, can you imagine following a guy like that? It's like, give me a break. And yet here it is, this pathetic picture of Saul who's totally lost his perspective. He's not hearing from the Lord anymore. The Lord is not speaking to him, and now he is just trying to hold on to his power. This is a good picture of politics, you know. Politics has two things in mind. Getting power, well, three things. Getting power, maintaining their power, and increasing their power. And it doesn't matter who you walk on to make those things happen. And yet the authority that Jesus gives is so different. We should be among people as servants, caring for people, realizing the position of authority God has given you is only so that you can be a servant and help and facilitate others to grow in the Lord. That's what any spiritual leader in the church should be like. You're there not to build a little kingdom for yourself, not to get a little following of disciples after you so that you've got this little thing going for yourself, making a name for yourself. Rather, you should be stepping out of the way and seeing others raised up, facilitating others, recognizing their gifts, and stepping out of the way and getting them plugged into areas where their gifts can really be used in the body. That's what it should be like. And it's pathetic when this happens, and this happens in the church very easily. I mean, when your time is up and God is calling you to something else, you've got to have the grace to recognize it. And I can say this. The Lord has called me here, but when the time comes, if it does come, that He calls me out of here, I hope I recognize His voice. I hope that I don't try to hold on to that which God is saying, now it's time to move on. Because very easily you can get yourself wrapped up in that for security's sake. And this is the picture of Saul. Well, guess who answers him? Doeg the Edomite, who was set over the servants of Saul, said, "I saw the son of Jesse going to Nob, to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. And he inquired of the Lord for him and gave him provisions and gave him the sword of Goliath, the Philistine." Now, in the psalm that is in reference to this particular thing, I believe it's, I had it written down here. I've lost my note on that. The particular psalm that speaks about this, it's an interesting picture because David knew that Doeg was going to be a problem to him. And certainly this has come to pass because Doeg is looking here for an opportunity for advancing himself in Saul's eyes to the point where he lies about what David did. He knew that David was coming just for help and that he lied to Ahimelech, did not tell Ahimelech what was going on, made Ahimelech feel that he was still with Saul, but Doeg sees an opportunity here for advancement for his own position. Proverbs 29:12 Interesting proverb. It says, if a ruler pays attention to lies, all his servants under him will become wicked. Why? Well, people will watch. The ruler is listening to lies. So you think, hey, that works. If it works for me, then. So they may become wicked and lie, thinking of only themselves, never quite telling the leader really what's going on. And Saul becomes a victim of his own sin. So the king sent to call Ahimelech, the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house, and the priests who were in Nob, and they all came to the king. And Saul said, hear now, son of Ahitub. And he answered and said, here I am, my lord. And Saul said to him, why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, in that you have given him bread and a sword and inquired of God for him? Now the inquiring of God would have been truly a trespass, because only the king would have had the authority to go to the priests and inquire of the Lord. And now it does not say Ahimelech inquired of the Lord for him. It does not. You look back here and you see this experience that he had with the priest. And basically he asks for bread, and he gets the bread, the provision, and then he goes his way. And yet Doeg is lying here, and he says he inquired of the Lord, and so that's what sets Saul off against Ahimelech and makes him not believe Ahimelech. But Ahimelech answered the king, says, who among all your servants is so faithful as David, who is the king's son-in-law, who goes at your bidding and is honorable in your house? Did I then begin to inquire of God for him? Far be it from me. Let not the king impute anything to his servant or to any in the house of my father, for your servant knew nothing of all this, little or much. And the king said, you shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house. And the king said to the guards who stood about him, turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because their hand also was with David, and because they knew when he fled and did not tell it to me, but the servants of the king would not lift their hands to strike the priests of the Lord. Bravo. The king said to Doeg, you turn and kill the priests. So Doeg the Edomite turned and struck the priests and killed on that day 85 men who wore a linen ephod. What a sick guy. And also Nob, the city of the priests, he struck with the edge of the sword, both men and women, children and nursing infants, oxen, donkeys, sheep, with the edge of the sword. Now here it's believed by some, because the Gibeonites were called to be servants to Israel to carry the water and the provisions for the priests, that they believed that the city of Nob was largely populated by Gibeonites. And this is where Saul did that dastardly deed that later on his descendants suffer as a result of that. Now one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. And Abiathar told David and Saul that Saul had killed the Lord's priests, and David said to Abiathar, I knew that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have caused the death of all the persons of your father's house. Stay with me, do not fear, for he who seeks my life seeks your life, but with me you shall be safe. So what a picture here to get to such a place where Saul has backslidden so far, he's killing the priests of the Lord. And yet David still has not gotten a very clear answer. But one little bright ray of hope here is he has now Abiathar with him, who is the priest, who is the one who is going to be able to inquire of God for him. He has a direct communication now, because that's how the Lord used through the priest. And in fact, on later in the next chapter, we'll learn that Abiathar actually escaped with the ephod and was able to inquire of the Lord with the implements of the Urim and the Thummim. And David now has a connection to hear the direction of the Lord. So through this bad incident, God is using for good in the life of David. One last note on the killing of the priests. If you remember back when Eli the priest was not listening to the Lord, his sons were totally off the wall and Eli did nothing to restrain them, a judgment was pronounced upon Eli and all of his house. And that judgment said that not one would remain of all of his household. Now it took many years, but this judgment came to pass. Not that God directly ordered it, but you see, the difficulty we have oftentimes with the Lord is the things that he allows. Ultimately, though, if you understand that God is in control. What he allows, really, it's not that he has directly caused the evil to come upon the priests, but the situation is, the inscrutable wisdom of the Lord is this. He knows where a person is going to go down the wrong road. He also knows the consequences of somebody else's sin down the road. And from his perspective, he sees it all as a pattern. And that which he pronounces judgment is actually his prediction also of what will happen. Now, can anything be done to change any of those things? Or is it such a fatalistic picture that that's the way it's going to be? I don't believe so. Because the picture I have of the Lord is he's compassionate and merciful. But when all things are left to progress, when sin is left to progress in a person's life, it has its consequences. You know, you can't play games with God. You see, oftentimes we continue in sin because we do not see immediate results or immediate consequences for our sin. And the proverb or the Ecclesiastes says that because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the hearts of the sons of men are fully inclined to do evil. In other words, because we don't get immediate repercussion for our sin, we kind of think, hey, it's not so bad. And we continue in it. But the Lord says, you know, that you sin, the lust brings forth sin, and sin eventually death. It will have its consequence. And it's important to realize that. At the same time, that there is always mercy when a person goes to the Lord. In fact, when you look at the picture of Jonah, it's a perfect picture. Jonah was told to go to Nineveh to preach to them and tell them judgment was going to come in 40 days. Well, Jonah didn't go. He ran from God. Now, the reason he ran, we later find out, is because he hated the Ninevites and didn't want them to repent. Didn't want to even give them an opportunity. Said, let God just kill them. So he knew that if he went, that they would listen and God would spare the city, and he didn't want that. He did not want God to be merciful to these very cruel people. So he ran. Well, God eventually got him back on track via the whale and throwing him up on the shore there and having to go to Nineveh and preach eventually. But he comes into the city. Can you imagine his anger against the people? He hates them. It's 40 days you guys are going to be toast, you know. And he goes and sits up on a hill and waits for the fireworks. Can't wait for this to happen. But you know, the whole city repents. Now, God had predicted 40 days they were going to be destroyed. I mean, that's it. Judgment pronounced. And yet they repent. And God relents. He lets them go. And then Jonah was ticked off at God for that. And the rest of the story is just seeing Jonah work it out with God and realize that God was merciful. And that was the whole point of the book. And yet the picture to me is that though the judgment was pronounced on the house of Eli, I believe that that could have been stopped had it not been, you know, for the continuation of sin for Saul and the various things, because the sin of one is going to affect somebody else. Ask that to somebody who gets raped out on the street. It's somebody's sin that's caused that. Did the person who was raped do something to deserve that? No. I don't believe so. Was God punishing that person who got raped because of where they were at? I don't believe so. But the sin and the free will that he has allowed others still have their consequence in other people's lives, and yet God can even turn those things around for good, as he does with this situation. Eventually, Abiathar is raised up to be the priest until the time of Solomon, and everything starts coming together for the house of David. But it was on the heels of judgment from another error. So it's an incredible thing when you start piecing some of these things together, and yet God is in control. God can even turn those things around for good, as he does with this situation. Eventually, Abiathar is raised up to be the priest until the time of Solomon, and everything starts coming together for the house of David. But it was on the heels of judgment from another error. So it's an incredible thing when you start piecing some of these things together, and yet God is in control.